Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you for joining me for another exciting episode of New Book Network's African American Studies podcast. I am your host, Katrina Anderson. Today, I am joined by Nick Tabor, who is a freelance journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Magazine, the New Republic, the Washington Post, Oxford American, the Paris Review, and many other places. Today, we will be discussing his first book, Africa Town, America's Last Slave Ship and the Community It Created. Thank you for joining me today, Mr. Tabor.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about the book. But first, I want to go into, let's talk about the story of the Clotilda. Can you, for our listeners, can you explain exactly what this was?
Certainly, yeah. So I always like to start with a little bit of context. You know, Mobile is not that big of a city now, but in the 1850s, it was the third largest port city in the United States.
I know, it's my hometown. And now, you know, you think about it and it's like, historically it was large and it was so important, you know, well, so it's great.
Yeah, it was kind of at the geographic center of the cotton trade, which, you know, had extended west along those Gulf states, into Alabama, into Mississippi and Louisiana. And because it's down there at the bottom of the state, right along the Gulf Coast, it has all these rivers, like five rivers that feed into it, from higher up in Alabama. It was very logical place for cotton to be shipped to, from the agricultural parts of the state, and then they could be shipped out. It could be shipped out along the Gulf of Mexico. So you read these accounts from the 19th century of how there would be ships from like every European country. You could see their flags blowing in the wind in the out there in the harbor. It was quite an international place back then, a little bit more so than it is now. So the first character in our story here is a guy named Timothy Mayer, who, you know, I always tell people that he reminds me of Colonel Thomas Sutpen from Faulkner's novel Absalom, Absalom. He came from Maine, moved down to Mobile when he was a young man, and built kind of a small business empire for himself. He owned a plantation, he had a shingle factory and a lumber yard, and a shipyard, all a ways outside of town. They called it Mayer's, his little domain, they called it Mayer's Hummock, just like Sutpen had his Sutpen's Hundred. And so besides Mayer's business enterprises, he was heavily involved in politics, like not so much at the electoral level, but he was a big proponent of the cause of trying to reopen the transatlantic slave trade. Since 1808, it had been illegal to bring enslaved people over from West Africa. If you wanted to buy them, you had to purchase them from within the United States, usually from states like the Carolinas, Virginia, Maryland. And so the demand for their labor, for the labor of enslaved people, was so high in those years leading up to the Civil War, that a lot of Southern businessmen started crusading to overturn that ban and to make it legal to bring slave ships over from West Africa once more. Mayer and some of these other businessmen also had a vision of this. I feel like this is a forgotten chapter of American history. Like, they had this vision of the United States annexing parts of Latin America and extending slavery there too, to places where it had been outlawed for a long time. And they pictured the antebellum South being at kind of the center of this empire. And Mayer in particular imagined Mobile being at like the geographic center of that. And so he named his one of his ships the Southern Republic, as a testament to that vision. Kind of tells you where what his agenda was. So, you know, there had been a lot of illegal slave ships brought over over the decades since it had been made illegal, and many U.S. presidents had just pardoned the slave dealers. But under James Buchanan, in the 1850s, the federal government was saying it was going to crack down on these voyages. And the lore is that Mayer was on the Mobile River one night. He had some passengers from the north, and they were all in the cabin saying, well, with this crackdown, like, there's no way that anybody's going to attempt to bring an illegal slave ship over now. Like, they're going to give him the death penalty. So surely this is going to be the end of it. And Mayer supposedly said, au contraire. he supposedly said, I'm telling you, I can bring a shipload of enslaved people over, and I'm not going to be prosecuted for it. And they're definitely like, nobody's going to be hung for this. And in some of the later versions of the story, it's the version. That we've received, like, the lore is that there was a bet. He said, I bet whatever amount of money that I can do this. In Mayer's own version, he doesn't say it was a bet, but anyway, he supposedly said he was going to do it. And then in 1860, he pulled it off. He hired a captain to go over there to the port city of Ouida, brought 110 men, women, and children back over to Mobile. It sneaked through Mobile Bay. A few people were arrested, but the cases were eventually dismissed. As Mayer said, nobody was executed for it. And the Civil War broke out 9 months after these people arrived. And so it was, as far as we know, it was the last slave voyage to the United States.
That is just so, you know, when you wrap your mind around everything that you just said, it's mind-boggling, yet it's not, given, you know, the importance of cotton to the South, and especially, you know, Mobile being a port city. But, you know, and Mayer, he seemed like quite the character, extremely confident, and he did pull it off. You know, and I guess he was aware that others had gotten away with this. So why not try his luck? And it worked out for him because, as you say, the Civil War broke out. And that was kind of the end of any discussion of this. But I want to talk about the actual slave voyage of the Clotilda itself. Can you speak a little bit for listeners? What was that like?
Yeah, I can. The person who captained the ship, the Clotilda, when it made that voyage was named Bill Foster, or William Foster. He was a ship carpenter who came from Nova Scotia, came from a long line of ship carpenters. And like Mayer, he moved down to Mobile when he was a young man. The southern United States was sort of America's frontier at that time in the 1820s and 30s. And So Foster had a long time relationship with Mayer. He had actually built the Clotilda at Mayer's shipyard. There's a theory now that even though the Clotilda was built 5 years before it made this voyage to West Africa, that it was actually built with the illegal slave trade in mind. And I have to say that I'm pretty persuaded of this. I think it's true. The theory is that it was making these short voyages, like to Cuba, maybe elsewhere in the West Indies and then in the Caribbean, and then running like smaller numbers of enslaved people up into port cities like New Orleans and along the Texas coast. So it made a bunch of voyages in those years to places where we know that illegal slave trafficking happened. And sometimes it would have unsigned cargo on the paperwork. And so it was built in a way that made it just perfect for this voyage. It was very fast and sleek, but it also had a huge storage capacity, much larger than most like Gulf area schooners that were built in that period. So this was Foster's ship. He had built it. He was also the captain on this voyage. He sailed with his crew of about a dozen men over to, as I said, the city of Ouidah, which is in the Gulf of Guinea, in the area that, that Europeans used to call the slave coast. And he had information, it had been in American newspapers, that the Kingdom of Dahomey was selling quite a lot of enslaved people. And Dahomey controlled this, this city of Ouidah. So Foster was there on land for about 10 days. He purchased, ended up being 110 men, women, and children, brought them on his ship, kept them for the most part in this you know cavernous space in this hold where they had no like no light could come in. They were their bodies chafed against the wooden floor. Of course, they had no place to urinate, except the places where they were lying. So it just the area just became more and more filthy. It was extremely hot. The ship was being rocked violently, and so they were tumbling about. Surely, many of them got like violently seasick. After I think it was 2 weeks into the voyage, Foster brought them up onto the deck, like in sort of shifts in groups, so that they could move their muscles a little bit. And at first, they said they needed help just to walk around, like they needed people to hold their shoulders and support them because their muscles had become so atrophied. And they were these people had. Certainly never been on the ocean. Probably many of them were from inland and probably had never seen the ocean before they were sold. And they were just terrified. There was like no way in their understanding of the world and geography. Like they didn't really have a way of understanding what was going on or where they were. There were violent storms at a couple points during the way back. There were a couple of moments where Foster was afraid that they were going to get caught because the British Royal Navy was heavily patrolling the Atlantic Ocean. But ultimately, they did make it back. They arrived in July of 1860. And the accounts differ a little bit on exactly how they managed to sneak the ship through. I have to say, it's unclear to me whether it happened in a single day, a single night, or if it was spread out across 2 days. I think it might have been 2 days. All of these different versions of the story that were written in like the 1890s and the early 1900s, they contradict each other on a lot of points, and then there are things that just don't quite make sense. But we know that they got it through, and. In the like probably in the late evening, they unloaded all of these people to another boat, and Mayer had a ship called the Tsar that he had his brother captaining that night. Unloaded them onto the Tsar, and then Foster stacked his ship, the Clotilda, with firewood, 7 cords of firewood, and torched the thing in this bayou. This area that was far removed from the city where nobody would see it. He burned it down to the water line. The steam was coming out as it sank. and then the bottom of the ship, which was underwater, survived intact, but it sunk to the riverbed. So Foster and a couple of other accomplices were arrested, or at least they were charged with just minor offenses, things like failing to register when they came back to the States. But those cases were eventually dismissed because, if as I said, 9 months after the ship arrived, the Civil War started, and the Alabama didn't see itself as part of the Union anymore. So those cases were in federal court. So of course they got thrown out. So in the end, no punishment.
It's once again mind-boggling as you think about, you have this slave voyage to go get human commodities, as they thought of them, human property, and what the enslaved endured during the transatlantic voyage is, there's no way you can even imagine it, you know, what they had to go through, because, as you said, they are on a ship, and most of them do come from the inland. Most of them aren't from the cities, they are from the inland. So you can imagine the fear and the anxiety and just the illness that they faced from this whole experience. That's just the mental trauma, not to say the physical, or in the case of women, the sexual violence that they endured. And this is all before even getting to land. With the, you know, it's a lot to just wrap your mind around what happened. And then, you know, of course, for Foster, you need to cover up the crime that you have committed. So I'm going to burn the ship and pretend this never happened. Yet you have this group of people from Africa whose life has been completely disrupted, uprooted. And then in some ways, the Civil War breaks out. So the question becomes, you know, like, what's going to happen to them? And, you know, can you speak about, like, what happens to those 100 and so enslaved Africans who've come over? You know, the question is, what happens even as the Civil War, you know, is breaking out and everything is happening? You know, of course, they're going to be sold and they're going to go to a plantation. But, you know, granted that by that time you have, since the Atlantic slave trade is done, you're going to have more what has been called homegrown enslaved African Americans in the South who were born there. So how do these West Africans fit into that?
Yeah, they were all of them, as far as we know, were enslaved for 5 years during the Civil War. So they were taken up to plantation shortly after the voyage ended. And a lot of these people were sold off to other buyers in different parts of Alabama. We know that some of them ended up close to Selma. A lot of them, we don't know exactly where they wound up. But at least a few dozen of them stayed in the Mobile area. A good number were enslaved by the Mayer family themselves. And so some of them worked on Mayer's plantation, like full-time. Others, including Cudjoe Lewis, who's the one that we know the most about, because he lived for a long time and he told a lot of stories about his life. He was on one of Mayer's steamboats, so he would go up and down the river on these trips to like fetch cotton, to drop off passengers, and he would have to get off at all these stops and help load and unload cargo. So he gave some pretty vivid descriptions of his life on the boat, the way that sometimes he and the others would be expected to dance for the entertainment of white passengers. So 5 years they were enslaved. Their lives on the plantation were difficult in a number of ways, in addition to the usual hardship and cruelty that they would have faced, there was also a shortage of goods and food because of the war. There was a blockade of Mobile by the Union Army, or the Union Navy rather. And so, like Cudjoe talked about, how they didn't have any sugar to sweeten their coffee. They tried using molasses, but it was gross. And they also had trouble getting along with other enslaved people on the plantations who had been born in the United States. Their skin was very dark, and they didn't speak good English, and they didn't know. In some cases, they didn't really know what was expected of them. They didn't know the protocols that were sort of standard for dealing with the masters. So they kept alive some of their own traditions. We have stories about them doing funerals when somebody in their ranks died during those years. It seems like they kept to themselves to a large extent. But they were definitely survivors. They were definitely defiant. There's one story about, and of course these are common in literature of slavery, but in fact we have two stories about sort of like, I wouldn't exactly say uprisings or rebellions, but on the plantation, but cases where like in one case where an overseer hit one of the women, and the men all scared this guy out of his wits, all the West African men. And so they said that none of the overseers ever tried anything like that again. In another case, there was a woman who worked in the mayor's home. She was a cook. Her name was Aunt Polly. And she smacked a girl, one of the West African girls, on the head. The woman, the girl screamed really loud, and all of the men from the out in the fields apparently came rushing in, carrying spades and rakes and whatever they had. And Aunt Polly ran up the stairs. She was terrified. And so one of the American-born enslaved people managed to calm them down. And the cook ended up leaving and finding work in Mobile instead. So they were definitely kind of a class apart. It took a long time for them to develop relationships with people born in the U.S.
That makes sense because, you know, culturally they are different in some ways, and thankfully, many of them sought to retain their cultural aspects, and, you know, they were resilient and they were strong in the face of the enormous adversity that they were facing during that time. So not only did they survive the Middle Passage, but they had to quickly adjust to a new way of life, and they did. And they showed strength, and they were protective of women and members of their community. So that's really great that they were able to accomplish that. And so as all of this is going on, they've got the backdrop of the Civil War that's going on at the same time as they're learning how to fit in. So I want to ask you, where does that take us as all of this is happening? So how do we get to Africatown? How was it actually founded and established?
Right. Well, in 1865, of course, these people were all emancipated. There's a story that Cudjoe tells about going down to the harbor where they were used to, they expected to report every day. He was planning to get on the boat, and nobody was there. The downtown area was, I guess, kind of dead, or the they're sort of one and the same. I mean, the town backs up against the, as you know, since you're from there, the town backs up against the water. So they wondered what was going on, and they saw these Union soldiers standing there picking berries off of mulberry trees. And the soldiers told them, "You guys are free. You don't belong to any anyone anymore. And they were like, well, what do you mean? Like, so where do we go then? Where are we supposed to go? And they were like, wherever you feel like there aren't any rules for you anymore. I mean, there was, in a way there were rules, but they didn't belong to anyone anymore. So they, of course, they kind of regrouped. Some of the people who were not in Mobile apparently made their way back down. And their first hope was to go back to West Africa. They, I found one interview done in, I think, the early 1900s, where they actually said that they saved up money for a matter of months working wage jobs, and then approached Bill Foster, the captain, and said, can we pay you to take us back? And he said, oh, this is like a tiny fraction of what that would cost. Sorry, I'm not going to take you back. There's no way you're going to be able to raise enough money to pay for that. So that, and even if they had been able to make their way back, it would have been difficult for them to find their homes. It's not like they could have taken a map of the continent of West Africa and pointed to exactly where they were from. So they were kind of marooned in Alabama. And the next best thing for them, the next best thing to going back, was to just buy a bunch of property and like pool their wages, help each other build homes, and establish a little community of their own where they could be sort of left alone, where they could speak their own languages, where they could appoint their own leaders, where they wouldn't be mocked by other people for their West African ways, their accents. And during Reconstruction in the 1870s, they managed to do this. They were able to purchase a bunch of land. It was all in an area separated from the city by a swamp. It was close to where Mayer's business operations were, and so this was not such a desirable part of town. And over time, more people who had been born in the United States also came to this area, and there were some who had already lived around there, but it became the population became pretty mixed. This little West African village was a distinct part of the area, but over time, the descendants of the West Africans married in with people who had been born in the U.S. and the distinction sort of began to blur.
It's so amazing that they were able to found like their own community, that they, you know, settled this area. Granted, it's not the most desirable area, but they were able to settle it, and they were able to create something lasting that was their own. So I want to ask you, how did you become involved with Africatown, and what was it that you were trying to do?
Yeah, very, very good question. Well, Kojo Lewis survived until the 1920s, until the 1930s. He was about 95 when he died. He was 18 when he was brought over, or roughly 18. And so he was the last one in Mobile County who was still alive. And he became a subject of quite a lot of interest for journalists at the national level. And in 1927, a young woman named Zora Neale Hurston came to interview him. At the time, she was a student at Barnard College here in New York. She was studying anthropology, and she was also heavily involved in the Harlem Renaissance movement. And so she, as an anthropology student, she was asked to come down and interview Kudjo and record his whole story before it was too late. And then after her first visit, she was asked by a wealthy white woman in New York to go back and to make a whole book out of it, to interview him at length. And she ended up staying for weeks and spent quite a lot of time with Kudjo. And so she wrote this manuscript, but it ended up being shelved for decades. It wasn't published until 2018. It's called Barracoon. And I bring all that up because it is connected to how I got involved. In 2018, in the months leading up to the publication of that book, I was on staff at New York Magazine. My editor called me into her office one morning and said, "Hey, this long lost book by Hurston is coming out, and we're going to be publishing an excerpt of it in the magazine." They gave us permission to print the first chapter. So she said, "I have this idea. I think it would be great if we could figure out what became of the family of Kojo Lewis, like where are his descendants now? And maybe we could have another little story alongside this one, kind of telling the rest of this story. So see if you can find him." And it took me a couple of weeks to track any of them down because they had kept a low profile intentionally. In the course of doing that, I learned about Africatown as it still exists. I learned that despite being this amazing historical treasure, this is the only community in the US that was established by people who had personally survived the Middle Passage, this place that was, it's a West African community in the United States. Despite its historical significance, there were really no monuments to speak of there. There was a bust of Kojo, but there wasn't much more. There was no museum. Instead, the place was surrounded by heavy industry. Like for decades, there had been two massive paper mills, kind of bookending the community, and those had left. But there was a lot of other heavy industry. There's still a lot of pollution in the community, and so when I got on the phone with one of Kojo's descendants, it was this guy named Gary Lumbers, who at the time was living outside of Philadelphia. He told me quite forcefully, as soon as we got on the phone, "You don't need to be writing about the descendants. You need to be writing about the neighborhood." He said, "I grew up there in the 60s, and it was this thriving community. It was a great place to grow up." He said, "There were like everybody had a big family. There were good jobs. There was a district of independent, mostly black-owned businesses." He was like, "None of that is there now. The population has dwindled. A lot of the houses are falling apart. You can't buy anything in the neighborhood." And he was like, "That was not a natural process. So what happened to it? What did they do to it?" And I managed to visit the community that same week, a few days after speaking to Gary. I happened to be there on a day when a law firm was kind of set up shop at one of the churches, and they were interviewing all these people about cancer cases and their families as they were in the process of suing one of the paper mills, and on the basis that their pollution had caused all these illnesses. So I spoke with a lot of people who said that numerous members of their families had died from cancer at young ages, and a lot of these people had survived cancer themselves, and their stories were harrowing. I mean, one person told me that they would often fish in the creeks nearby. It was like a cheap way of putting food on the table, and sometimes they would bring the fish home and cut them open, and they would be black on the inside because of all this pollution in the waterways, all effluent from the mills. And others since then have told me the same thing. It wasn't just that one guy. The blackened fish were a real thing. So I was kind of haunted by these stories when I came back to New York, and I kept thinking for a while, man, I wish I could just move down there and piece together the entire history, like everything leading up to Barracoon, but especially everything since then, like all of this industrial development, and figure out how it got to be this way exactly. And I thought, we could say it's racism, because like clearly it's not a coincidence that this community founded by the survivors of the last slave ship became the place where in southern Alabama, where the most heavy industry was concentrated, the place that had the highest pollution levels of any part of the region. Clearly, it's not a coincidence. But I also thought that unless I moved down there and went deep into the history and pieced together all of the steps and that led to this, like every decision that kind of like figured out how one thing sort of led to another, then we wouldn't really understand what the process was. I thought if I could do that and we could understand the process in Africatown, then it would explain a lot about how so many communities of color throughout the United States have experienced the same thing. You know, we call it environmental racism. So I approached some people I had met down there and asked them, what would you think about me doing this? You know, I'm a white journalist. I had never lived in Alabama before then. I was like, you know, it's not my story, it's yours. What would you think about me doing it? And the response I got almost universally was, look, we need all the help we can get. We're trying to bring more attention to this place and start to bring visitors to create a heritage tourism industry. So if you're going to do a responsible job of it, we would love to have you. So with their encouragement, I moved down to Mobile at the end of 2019.
And you were able to create this phenomenal book that you did. So I want to ask you, what was it like? How difficult was the research and writing process for doing all of this? Was it easy to get interviews? Were, you know, people willing to talk? I know they wanted to shed light on what had happened. As you say, they were trying to set up a heritage tourism. Were they open and receptive primarily to sharing the difficulties that they faced?
I was definitely able to get enough or more than enough from people living in Africatown and people who have since moved away. That's not to say that every person there was eager to talk to a reporter, but enough of them were. And I was really taken aback the first time I visited by how welcoming people were and how willing they were to share their stories. You know, I would not have moved down if I hadn't had that initial experience. It also helped having support from like the ministers in the community and other people in leadership. I would say that I had a more difficult time like navigating the white power structure there. One of my heroes, I would say my number one hero in nonfiction writing is Robert Caro, who is, of course, he wrote a thick biography of Robert Moses, the city planner in New York. And since then, since that came out for decades, he's been working on a multi-volume biography of Lyndon Johnson. He always talked in The Power Broker about how this guy, Robert Moses, wouldn't talk to him. So he had to create concentric circles around Moses and kind of work his way inward and try to find sources closer to Moses who would give him what he needed. I actually felt like it was, in a way, an inversion of that for me. I felt like I was starting with a small core of people in Africatown who I knew I could trust. And then I kind of worked my way outward from there in concentric circles. I was afraid that if I told the wrong person the wrong thing, then I might hit a tripwire and that avenues would start to close for me in my reporting. Mobile was a small enough town that a lot of people know, you know, it's not, maybe not everybody knows everybody, but a lot of people know a lot of people, and those connections are thick. And so I wanted to be careful about that. And I was fairly deliberate about how I went about it. In the end, in particular, I was trying to get information about the descendants of Timothy Mayer, the guy who brought the slave ship over, because they still own a lot of property surrounding Africatown. And over the decades, they've leased and sold it to a lot of industrial companies and made a lot of money that way. And they've always been kind of shrouded in secrecy in a way, especially for people in Africatown. They've the mayors are not very public people, and you would just hear the name The Mayors. You didn't really hear about like individual members of the family. There wasn't really a clear sense of who the individual members were or who was running things there. And so I did kind of take the inward concentric circles approach with them. I found people who knew them and and were willing to speak, you know, often anonymously about who they were and what they were like.
That makes sense. Mobile is it's not huge, it's smaller. And so there are people, you know, especially when you're looking at different circles, it's like people know people in one little word. And as you said, that door will close. So you were very strategic in your planning. But I want to ask you, so I want to go back before we get to the environmental racism and the involvement of the industry in that. How did Africatown go from this booming, you know, place that was having lots of accomplishments to, you know, in some ways, not a failure, but just losing its prestige? What happened?
Yeah, there were a few factors there. I wouldn't say it was a process of deindustrialization, but both of the paper mills did close. One of them still operates like one plant there. I think it's a tissue mill, but for the most part, they wound down their operations in Africatown in the 90s. By 2000, they were both closed, and so that did mean a lot of jobs going away. There other factories have replaced those, but they don't necessarily employ as many people, and often the jobs require some, as I understand, you have to have some kind of technical training or expertise that, unlike what the paper mills used to be, where they would hire just anybody they could, they just needed as much labor as they could get for a while. There was also the end of, I don't want to overstate it, but like the to some extent, like the end of housing discrimination, the Fair Housing Act, that made it possible for people in Africatown to buy homes in what had once been the white suburbs. And so a lot of people voluntarily moved away. They were making good money at those mills, and they were able to save up enough to buy bigger, newer houses. But some of it was also the action of the government. In the 1980s, they built a highway. And this is probably the single biggest factor. They built a highway through the community and wiped out the business district. They actually dug up part of the cemetery and paved over it. And a lot of houses, I think about a dozen houses that were, according to oral history, which I trust, I think it's accurate. According to the oral history, these houses had been built by people who were on the Clotilda. So these were amazing historical artifacts, architectural artifacts. They had been built on top of, like they had been added onto because the families needed more space, but the core of these homes was still the homes that were built by their ancestors. And the state built this highway and wiped them all out. The state knew what they were doing. The descendants pleaded with them not to do it. The state said, look, if you want to move these houses at your own expense, that's fine, but we have a deadline. Like, we've got to start construction by X date. And if they're not out of the way, then we're bulldozing them. And for the most part, that was what happened. So, I mean, that it's now a, you know, 55 mile an hour highway carrying hazardous cargo. Trucks go faster than 55. It goes right through the center of the neighborhood, kind of cut it into two halves. It used to be a walkable, a pedestrian friendly business corridor. And now it's just a highway. So, so any sense of like physical integrity that it had as a bigger neighborhood was kind of destroyed by that.
That speaks so many volumes. That you have a highway through the middle of the town, that, you know, that says a lot about so many things. So, you know, the people, of course, as you said, those historical artifacts, those homes, they were just bulldozed and gotten rid of. And, you know, the memories, I'm sure, for the residents that they had of those, I'm sure that was that was a layer of trauma in and of itself that occurred. And so, you know, in some ways I want to ask you, has this just what occurred in Africatown, has it been ignored? You know, that all of this was happening. It just kind of flew under the radar. You know, what would you say?
I mean, with regard to the stuff that happened in the 80s, like the highway construction, I would say that as much attention as the neighborhood has gotten in recent years, you know, there have been several books. There have been several documentaries, including one that I was involved with, Descendant, which is on Netflix. Descendant does make reference to the highway, but I had to piece together for myself what happened. The story had never really been recorded anywhere. More broadly, I would say that one interesting thing about this story is that I feel like there's a, like, we might assume that it had been covered up for years and years. In fact, white people in Mobile, especially, you know, Timothy Mayer, they were proud of this story for a long time. It was sort of celebrated by white Mobile for decades. And as early as the day after the ship arrived, there was a news report about it in papers that ended up being syndicated all over the U.S. and even in Europe. And I think that Timothy Mayer probably tipped the reporter off himself, because I don't know how else the journalist would have found out about it. And I mean, I found these news clips from the 1960s, two interviews that one of his grandchildren did with a civil rights newspaper in Mobile, Southern Courier. And in one of these stories, there's a picture of him posing next to a poster of the Southern Republic, his grandfather's ship. So in those same years, people in Africatown, a lot of them were sort of embarrassed about the story. I think there was sort of this colonial mentality where they were, like, association with Africa felt like a shameful thing. And having such a close connection to it felt like a source of shame and embarrassment. So there are people who grew up there who say that they didn't learn about it growing up. But in the 70s, that all kind of turned on its head. Alex Haley's book Roots came out, the miniseries came out on TV, and it was insanely popular. And people started to become interested in African-American genealogy. And Africatown started to really champion its own story. And it got quite a lot of international press in the 80s. It had these festivals where diplomats from West Africa would come over. Some black celebrities came for these things. Alex Haley himself was there one year. Jesse Jackson made a bunch of trips down. And there was a lot of press coverage. But at the same time that all that was happening, the state was actively destroying the historic neighborhood. And that did not get so much attention. And then I would say that this chapter has pretty much been forgotten up until now.
Wow, that is shocking, yet not shocking so much. As I'm conceptualizing all of that and thinking about home, yes, that makes a lot of sense. So I want to ask you, you know, the impact of the environmental racism that the residents of Africatown, my gosh, you know, cancer, so prevalent within the community. Has anything really been done? You know, I know they were going kind of like, as one would say, you know, the Aaron Brockovich route of getting the lawyers and, you know, trying to sue certain parties. But, you know, how are they dealing with all of this just internally with the community? Could you get a sense of how they are handling what has been, you know, the cancer and just the way in which the Africatown has been destroyed in so many ways?
Yeah. Well, I would say that they're having more success now than they did in the 80s. I've always been a little bit concerned that the same kind of arc that we saw back then will play itself out again. where there was all this international attention, but in the end, it didn't really lead to much. There was no real capital investment there. And they had all these plans to build things like a museum, visitor center, none of it ended up happening because the money didn't come through. There has been some progress on that front this time around. There, the first real museum opened there this year, just a few months ago, in fact. It's called the Heritage House. And the person most responsible for that is a woman on the county commission named Mercyria Ludgood. She's an attorney, and she's a veteran of the civil rights movement in Mobile. So that's huge progress. It's really great to see the first piece of infrastructure for this heritage tourism project actually being built. And there are plans for a visitor center to be built in the near future too. There's a contract with the design agency, and I think it's going to be great. And there's a lot of other activity there. A group that's led by people who grew up in Africatown just did it. I want to make sure I get their name right. It's Africatown Heritage. They just did a big cemetery mapping program over the weekend. There's a lot of effort to sort of organize around the school, the Mobile County Training School, which was an amazing institution itself, and to revive the school. The Biden administration, one thing they've been pretty good on is finding money for environmental justice projects and working directly with community groups to make sure that the money gets into the right hands. And it looks as if these environmental groups that work with Africatown, one of them is called CHESS, another one's Africatown specific, there's another one called MEJAC, Mobile Environmental Justice Action Coalition, which works on environmental justice issues throughout Mobile County. But again, its roots are kind of in Africatown. Looks like they're lined up to potentially receive quite a lot of grant money from the federal government. So there are some things happening. We are actually seeing some progress this time.
I am very, very happy to hear that, because I feel like in so many ways that it's been overlooked, and the people there have been forgotten for the most part, and their experiences. So it's nice that to see them actually getting, you know, the credit and the tourism that will come from having these structures in place, so that they can share the history of Africatown with others. It's very unique history, and that hopefully they can also get justice for the environmental racism that they have faced and the debilitating impact that has had on the health of the community. So I am definitely rooting for that wholeheartedly. I know I really want to see good things come from this, because they deserve it. They most definitely deserve it. So I want to ask you, what do you think the legacy is of Africatown?
Well, I think it's certainly a legacy of struggle and survival, and of self-determination. I mean, it's amazing to think about, it's amazing to think about the way they dealt with the hardships that they faced. It almost sounds cliche to say this, I guess, but like, how else can you react when you think about them? Like all the different chapters in their early lives, like the horrors of first being kidnapped by another West African country, seeing their family members slaughtered, being marched all the way to the coast where they were put in these cages, and then surviving that horrific trip across the Atlantic Ocean that I described, and then being enslaved for 5 years and not having any idea what was going to happen to them. And then I imagine there was kind of a new kind of terror, even as it was exhilarating for them to be freed again. At the same time, they were just left to their own devices in this strange, unfamiliar land. The way that they managed to be resourceful and make the best of that situation and create really rich lives for themselves here in the United States. It certainly is resilience and courage and strength. And I don't know how you could look at that and not feel inspired by it. But also, I think about all the generations since then, the way they, each in their own ways have had to struggle to keep this community intact and to preserve the history. It's like that legacy of survival and resilience doesn't end in the 1930s when Cudjoe Lewis died. You see it transmitted through another 90 or so years up to the present day through his descendants and through the other people who lived in Africatown who were not descendants, who were just as much a part of that community.
Yeah, I could say you can definitely, I agree, see the resilience and the courage and the overwhelming adversity that they faced, yet they did not give up and they persevered and they kept moving forward. So what do you want readers to take away from the book?
Well, I'd like for them to, it depends on who the reader is, I guess, but I often think about how when I was a conservative teenager, I felt like, I'm not so sure that we need affirmative action anymore. And I felt like, racism was bad, but mostly it's in the past. And I feel like if I had been exposed to this story back then, especially the way I tried to present it in this book, then it probably would have changed my whole understanding of racism and the legacy of racism and the way it still manifests now. Not just in people's attitudes, but in things like the physical geography of our cities. I hope it'll raise awareness about environmental racism, and I hope it'll raise awareness about this particular community. And people should go visit. I mean, there's a museum there now. They're welcoming visitors, it really is a beautiful place. There's a lot there to see. It's a great place to go reflect on some of these questions of history and the legacy of racism and emancipation.
I agree. Thank you so much for joining me today, Mr. Tabor. It has been a pleasure discussing Africatown with you and talking about the community and the people who were in it.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks again for having me on.
Readers, please go out and pick up a copy of the book Africatown, America's Last Slave Ship and the Community That It Created by Nick Tabor. I want to say it is well written. It is well researched. It is overall excellent. And I'm not just saying this because I am a native Mobilian. It's a really great book that tells the history of a community that has been ignored or marginalized for so long. And, once you get sucked in as you're reading about the Clotilda and the Voyage, but it doesn't stop there. It takes you into the lives of the members of the community and that courage and resilience that they faced in overwhelming odds and that many of the residents still face today. So I urge you, please go out and pick up a copy. You will not regret reading this book.